The readings today are really good. I'm going to read them all. First is just a short passage from Galatians. And this is written by Paul at a time when the church is struggling with who's in and who's out. And Paul has this universal vision that he sometimes lives out but sometimes doesn't, as true for all of us. But just listen to what he said. My understanding of this passage is that he's saying, you know, in the past there were all kinds of things keeping us apart. How about we just dump them and just be one? So, well, this is how he says it. It's slightly more poetic than that. Before faith came, we were imprisoned and guarded under the law until faith would be revealed. Therefore, the law was a disciplinarian until Christ came so that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we're no longer subject to a disciplinarian. For in Jesus, you're all children of God. You're all children of God. As many of you as were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves. Therefore, there is no longer Jew nor Greek. There is no longer slave nor free. There is no longer male nor female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. Here's a story from Luke. Something about that very thing. I'm not going to preach on it. So it's Luke 8, if you're following me, and we're going to start at 26. Jesus and his disciples are going around. Sometimes they're in Jewish territory, sometimes they're in Gentile territory, and they keep crossing over. And here's what happened. They arrived at the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And as he stepped out on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in the house, but in the tombs. And when he saw Jesus, he fell down before him, shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him. He was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, that he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wilds. Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion." For many demons had entered him, and they begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. Now, therefore, there on the hillside was a large herd of swine feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these. So the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake. And when the swineherds saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country, and the people came out to see what had happened. And when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. They were afraid, and those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed. And then all of the people of the surrounding country asked Jesus to leave them, because they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." So he went away, proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. If I were going to preach that, which I'm not, I would talk about two things. One, essentially, being returned to community, being restored to community, is the work of faith. Being restored to the people from whom you have been alienated is the work of faith. Period. 1 Kings 19. I'll give you the backstory later. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." And he was afraid, and he got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah. And he left his servant there. But he and Saul went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom bush. And he asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. And suddenly, an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." And he looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." And he got up, ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, to the mountain of God. And at that place, he came to a cave, and he spent the night there. Then the word of God came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, but the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they're seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Now there's a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces, but God was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But God was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But God was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence." When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave, and there came a voice that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I've been very zealous for God, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed the prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they're seeking my life. Take it away." And God said, "Go and return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. And you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, as prophet in your place." This is so good. This is good, good stuff. I know I keep saying this, but it keeps on being true that this picture, this story, this piece of scripture has sermons just falling out of it all over the place, and it's hard to pick just one, and it deserves so much more than I'm able to give it today. The good news is the stories of Elijah and Elisha are going to be pretty much all through the summer, so you haven't heard the last of them. So I'll tell you a little bit about what's been going on in my life these past 2 weeks. This happens a lot, but I think the fact that the summer is upon us, kind of, and people are laying down a lot of their committee work and other commitments and trying to discern which of those layers down is temporary and what they need to let go of and what they'll pick up again in the fall, I think that has something to do with it. People are in my office, not exactly sitting under a broom bush, but often pretty close. Tired, and discouraged, having worked hard and long at matters that matter. And so many of you are engaged in work that really matters, with organizations and groups that are seeking to make a difference, to call the world and the community back to the ways of sanity and compassion and justice and truth. So many of you are involved in the work of social justice and climate change and reconciliation and poverty and housing, and you work hard. You work hard, and sometimes you get feeling like it doesn't make a difference. Sometimes you pay a price for your passion, personally and socially, or even in your jobs. I don't know. Sometimes you just want to lie down under a broom bush and say, I'm no better than the people who came before me, like I quit. And sometimes, when it's known that you're doing the work you're doing because of your faith, that's harder still, because people of faith are increasingly misunderstood and judged before they begin. Their motives are questioned and beliefs assumed, and you can pay a price for that too. You want to wear a sign saying, yes, I go to church, but I'm not like that. And then you say, or am I? And you get double guessing yourself, right? In the ways that drain energy from what's really important. And you know how that goes. I think you do. So 35 years ago, I was ordained into this work. And at that time, we sang a hymn. And part of one line in that hymn said, I will go where you send me. I will hold your people in my heart. And when I sang that, I meant it. And I've always tried to do that. I hold you in my heart. And I'm feeling your fatigue, and I'm feeling your grief for how things used to be when you had more energy and maybe more naivete about things, I don't know. And I'm feeling your fear about the future, and maybe not despair, but questioning, is this worth it? I'm holding that and you in my heart. And then this text pops up. And this story, like most of the stories of Elijah and Elisha, has all the marks of a great piece of poetry, of sacred text. It smells old. You can tell it's ancient, and that we'll never completely understand it, but it calls and it coaxes and it teases you a little bit. It smells of burning sands and foreign spices, but there's also something here intimate and familiar. Kind of feels like our heart's home. It's a mystery, and it's beautiful. And my role in this is just to invite you into that mystery. I'm not going to tell you what it means. That would be to seriously overestimate my ability and what my job is. Frederick Buechner, in a kind of rant about this, warns preachers who try to reduce or explain a story. This is what he says. Scientists speak of intelligent life among the stars, of how at the speed of light there is no time, of consciousness as more than just an epiphenomenon of the physical brain. Doctors speak seriously about life after death, and not just the mystics anymore, but the housewife, the stockbroker, the high school senior speak about an inner world where reality becomes transparent to a reality realer still. The joke of it is that often it's the preacher who, as steward of the wildest mystery of them all, is the one who hangs back, prudent, cautious, hopelessly mature and wise to the last, when no less than St. Paul tells her to be a fool for Christ's sake, no less than Christ tells him to be a child for his own sake and the kingdom's sake. Let the preacher tell the truth, and finally let her preach this overwhelming of tragedy by comedy, of darkness by light, of the ordinary by the extraordinary, as the tale that is too good not to be true, because to dismiss it as untrue is to dismiss along with it that catch of the breath, that beat and lifting of the heart near to or even accompanied by tears, which I believe is the deepest intuition of truth that we have. Frederick Buechner. So my role is to invite you into the text, and so into the mystery inside you, and among us, and beyond us. So we'll just step in. Of all the places this sermon could go, I want to stress two. To be a person of integrity, to be true to the light of the holy that is in you and in every living creature that breathes, to be true to what's real and right and ultimate, you have to do two things. The text says, I think. Speak out and step up when things are wrong. And take care of yourself, because doing that can be exhausting and can get you in all kinds of trouble, and you can't do it alone. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Both of those things are true. The brokenness of the world compels people with hearts and heads to speak up and act to change things. And the brokenness of the world can sometimes break you. And you need to do whatever you can to sustain yourself and care for yourself, because we're in this for the long haul. First, the speaking up part. That's what Elijah had just done when we need him here, and that's what prophets do. It's their job. Speaking truth to power. Not a good strategy for a career trajectory, but that's what people of faith do. They show up, and they speak up, and they step up. And you do it, in each of you, in your own ways. Here's how Elijah did it. I've got to give you some background. I'll try to be brief, but it's really interesting. At this time in the history of Israel, the country was divided. Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and there was no love lost between the two. Of course, this material is being written years after the events they describe. And the author has a particular point of view. Let's just say this author is not a monarchist. Ahab was king of Israel, and that's where Elijah lived. Ahab, this writer said, was not a good king. Then, to make matters worse, he marries Jezebel, a foreigner, a Phoenician princess, probably to cement some political alliance. So what's wrong with that? Well, she was not a worshiper of the God of Israel, but rather worshipped the Canaanite god Baal, and set up altars to Baal all through Israel. And she was hated, and Ahab along with her. And along comes Elijah, the prophet. He is furious. And he believes with all his heart that Ahab and Jezebel are taking the country down a road to destruction. And what are you going to do when you believe that those in power are taking the country down the road to destruction? Well, here's what Elijah did. He criticized, he belittled, he made their lives miserable. In chapter 18, he challenges the prophets of Baal to a contest. Essentially, it's a my God is can whoop your God, like the kind of thing you have in grade 3, but it's written as a comedy, as a cartoon, like political satire. And you read it when you get home to chapter 18. Ahab and Jezebel are furious. And Jezebel threatens his life. And that's where we find him at the beginning of this reading. He has spoken what he believes to be the truth. He's risked his life for that. He's worked long and hard and endured ridicule. There's a great passage where Ahab is here and he sees Elijah coming and he says something like, "What now, you troubler of Israel?" Prophets are troublers of powers that be. Anyway, he's followed what he believes is the truth, and where is it brought him? Jezebel has killed all the others, well, not all the others, and she's about to kill him as well, and he sits under a broom bush and he wants to die. Maybe he's thinking back and second guessing what he's been doing all those years. Maybe he's discouraged. And you know how you're when you're in that kind of a mood, you focus on all the things that you did wrong? All the things I should have, I could have, oh, I shouldn't have, like that. Maybe he's doing that and he ends up saying, oh, I know better than my ancestors, and he just wants to die. What happens is a messenger comes and says, "Get up and eat." And there, right before him, is a cake baked on hot coals and some water, and he eats. And he goes back to sleep, and it happens again. "Get up and eat." And the messenger says, "Eat, because the journey will be too long for you." And he does. And on the strength of that, it says he goes 40 days and 40 nights. He ends up in a cave. He's still not straight in his head. He's still not straight in his head. He's in a cave. You can be in a cave in all kinds of ways. It doesn't have to be your own cave. You know what I mean? And he's in a cave, and suddenly there are all these things, an earthquake and fire and wind, and he wants God to be in those. He wants God to do something, something obvious, some sign. No, no, no. And then there's silence. And the voice of God saying, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" And in the end, just like that demoniac in Luke, sends him back to exactly what sends him back to his life. Saying, "Go away." You know, and that text gives me goosebumps. And when I have been at my lowest, when I have been at my lowest, it has sustained me. Like bread and water in the desert. The text itself, the story itself, nourishment. And I have hugged it to myself, even when a kinder, gentler text would have given me more immediate but temporary comfort. So it makes me ask, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? Why do I go to meeting upon meeting when it would be easier to stay home on my couch? Why do I give money to this place, to other causes, given more immediate? Claims on what I have. Why do I do that when I could use resources for something more personal? I don't know, like a jacuzzi. I don't know. Why do you? You spend yourself and your resources in countless ways to make the world a better place, and I bet there are times when you sit under your own broom bush and say, "This isn't fair. It should be easier than this. Is this how you treat your people?" And you want some sign, you want some, even if it's selfish, maybe a little recognition, some inner deep peace at least, some assurance, and all you get is silence. And it drives you back to the basic question, why are you doing it in the first place? There was a professor of Christian ethics called Beverly Wildown Harrison. I was once at a conference where she was. And at that time, it was early 80s, and she was talking about feminism. But, like, fill in the blank of the social cause, it just applies. She said, "I used to think we were going to win this thing. I used to think that it would happen, and in my lifetime. I no longer think that we're going to win at all. But I keep doing it because I have to look at myself in the mirror and I have to be able to tell my children and my grandchildren that I did what I could." Why are you doing what you're doing? That's the question. It's bigger than you. And it doesn't depend only on you. But not to act, not to speak truth to power, not to do whatever you can, will do intense and painful violence not only to you inside, but to the light of God within you. And you're not alone. This scene acknowledges that sometimes there is only silence. And while silence can be beautiful and restorative and deep and filled with meaning, sometimes, not so much. Sometimes it's just silence when you need a word. And that's how it is. But even when there's only silence, even when there seems to be only a formless void, even then there is some translations say a still small voice. Others say, like this one, a sound of sheer silence. Still others say fine silence or a gentle whisper. The New English translation says, after the fire there was a sound. Thin, quiet, And the silence calls you back to who you really are and sends you back into the fray. That's the second part, though. The danger in preaching this to tired activists is to focus on this part, the get back into it part, but an equally strong thread. Here is the message to just rest and be fed. One bit of Bible study I can't resist says, he lay down and he slept, and the messenger came and said, get up and eat. And there was a cake baked on hot coals. And the scholars say that that word for coals is not a common word, not a word they normally use for coals used for cooking. The one other place it's found in the Bible is in Isaiah 6. Do you remember? Isaiah has a vision. The angels are singing, holy, 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 and one of them takes a what? A coal from the throne of God and brings it to Elijah to strengthen him and say, you can do this. A hot coal. And there's way more going on here than the first reading would reveal. So rest and be fed, otherwise the journey will be too hard for you. Sleep and eat and let others take care of you, because that too is holy work. That too is your life's work, your sacred task, taking care of yourself. Otherwise, this messenger says, the journey will be too hard. And the beautiful part of this reading is that these two things merge beautifully in the scene where the angel, another translation is messenger, someone taps him and says, you've got to eat. It's a perfect melding of the two things we've been talking about. You have to step up. You have to do the hard speaking truth to power work. And you have to be fed and rest. I find you can't read this really. Read about Elijah's trek across the desert to escape violence. One of the commentaries I read this week said, a 21st century mind, aware of global migration, and aware too that this has been true for millennia, wonders, did he come across human remains during that trek? Those who had tried that journey before him and didn't survive? A political, theological imagination pauses to ask that question. Well, I hadn't thought of that. But really, you can't read this without thinking of those who are doing that very thing right now, walking across deserts, hostile landscapes, escaping who knows what threats and violence left behind. And you can't think of that without thinking of those who are risking themselves to take water and bread. Those who are risking so much by being who they are in a hostile place and trying to escape, and those who are being who they are by trying to feed them, a perfect whole inhabiting the sacred realm, embodying the divine intent. So wherever you are along the freedom spectrum, whether you are an intense activist, a troubler of Israel, or whether you do it more gently, write letters to the editor, I don't know, give money and support those who do, whether you say to someone who is discouraged and despairing, how about I make your cake? Let's always be the community offering encouragement and support. And let this time together and what we do through the week be a place where cakes and water are offered, where the silence is honored. And when the question is asked, why are you here? And why do you do what you do? Let's honor that question. And again, when there is silence and response, let's honor that and trust Him. May God bless you and sustain you with cakes and water and each other. Amen.